introduce himself. And I'm going to start with Mike Towery next to me. Mike, say something about yourself, about how you got involved with the group and what you're doing today.
Well, my friend Richard Alf and Bob Thorpe is not here today.
Oh, Mike's not.
My friend Richard Alf, is it on?
Yeah, it's a little better. Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll speak a little louder.
Yeah. All right.
I'll try again. My friend Richard Alf, who's down the table here, and Bob Thorpe, who isn't here today, and I, we were all young comic dealers in the Sara Mesa Mission Village area of San Diego. And in 1969, we were contacted by Shel Dorf, who had got put on our trail, or Richard, by Barry Alfonso, who's next to me here. And we went and met with him and talked about Comic-Cons and starting a Comic-Con. And I guess the rest is history. It's in the Comic-Con book. And these days, I'm a computer programmer.
It's like to tell the truth.
And Gary Jensen?
I'm Bennett Stewart. I hate that.
I had to come up here for a moment, please.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gary Sass. I'm the director of print publications for Comic-Con. I just want to start off by saying that none of us would be here today if it wasn't for the gentlemen that are sitting up here. So I think we need to take a look at that. This all started 40 years ago because these guys thought it would be cool to put on Comic-Con. And 40 years later, we're the only continuously running comic convention in the country. And we're very, very proud of them. We're proud to have these guys back so we can honor them all weekend long. We've been at Comic-Con, we've been a little bit remiss about honoring a particular individual up here over the years, and that's why I'm here today to present the Inkpot Award to Mike Towery, who has never gotten one before.
You get the new cool one.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Right.
I don't
think
you have
to go. Got that for publishing this. It should be shaped like some clear glass.
All right. We'll continue on with introductions and just pass it on down. Barry?
Okay. Well, mostly what I can do is embellish what Mike just said. I was a newly turned 12 years old in the fall of 1969, and I had the idea of putting an ad in the local Penny Saver to see if anybody was selling any comic books. I knew a couple of people who were my age who liked comics. I didn't know there was such a thing as comic book fandom. I knew there were people in New York City and places like that selling comics, and at least one guy in San Diego that was, but that was it. I was totally isolated from that. So I put this ad in, and a man named Shel Dorf contacted me, who had some comics to sell, and I bought some from him, and he told me that he had an interest in pursuing an organized fan organization in San Diego. And I put him in touch with a guy I didn't know but had heard of, named Richard Alf, who had run an ad in the back of a Marvel comic issue. I don't know if I gave him Richard's phone number, but I think Shel probably looked in the phone book, which they had back then, and saw the Alf family at whatever address, and they got in touch with each other, and not long after that, I was invited to go to a meeting, and there were six of us there. There was Mike, there was myself, there was Shel Dorf, there was Bob Thorpe, who was mentioned. There was Dan Stewart. And am I leaving anybody out? I think that's it. And within the first or second meeting, we discussed the possibility of starting a comic convention. Shel had done one in Detroit, and we liked the idea, and it just sort of grew from there. And I was with the group for another 7 years. Presently, I'm a writer, I'm a journalist, I'm a songwriter, and I'm a retired supervillain. living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I'm Scott Shaw. I was in, very lucky to be, I went to Crawford High School here in San Diego. I grew up in San Diego. I was a Navy brat. And we had kind of a unique junior high school experience in that Roger here and Dave Clark and Greg Bear and John Pound, who couldn't make it here, who was one of the other key people, we were all the super nerds of the 1960s, at least as far as our high school was concerned. So it became a really great support group for each other because we were all into comics and science fiction and animation and stop motion animation and monster movies, the whole thing. We even had a so-called underground film society at Crawford High that we never made any underground films. In fact, we barely got the movie made that we said we were going to make. But I was working at B. Dalton Bookseller down in Fashion Valley. It had just opened, and I thought this was a real cutting-edge store, because I'll never forget, they had a whole display of the novelization of I Am Curious Yellow in the window. And I thought, man, if these guys know about Grove Press, this is a pretty cool place. And there I met Bob Sork, who came in looking for those bastardized children's books of using old Prince Valiant Sundays as the illustrations. And when he found out that I was an aspiring cartoonist and a comic collector, he told me that he had a group of friends who were also into comics. So I brought my friends, and we already had a group that met at Ken Kruger's store. He had a store down in Ocean Beach, and we called ourselves the Profanists, because some were pros, some were fans, and we were all very profane in our behavior and eating habits. I remember eating a lot of raw ground beef or something in your store. That causes a lot of things, my brain fever. Anyway, when the two groups got together, it really clicked, and I was involved with the convention, I think, the first 3 or 4 years. By 1975, I moved up to Los Angeles, and I've been to every day of every San Diego Comic Con over all 40 years. Only this audience would applaud something so utterly pathetic. I mean, that's just wrong. But it's very important to me somehow. I told my wife the other day, and she looked at me like she wanted to kill me twice over. I said, you know, if I don't die at my drawing table, I want to die at the Comic Con. Because I know that somebody would step up and sell the body parts off for pet food or something. But anyway, I'm currently, I live in Los Angeles. I've worked in a number of aspects as a cartoonist. I currently write and draw a lot of stories for the Simpsons comics. I created a comic called Captain Carrot and His Amazing Zoo Crew years ago with Roy Thomas. For years I was the art director and co-producer of all the Pebble cereal commercials with the Flintstones selling you this horrible crap. Been better off eating the boxes. I hope none of you ever fell for that. I've designed a lot of toys for Todd McFarlane a few years ago, and I produced a lot of TV shows. I did Completely Mental Misadventures of Ed Grimley with Martin Short. I did Camp Candy with John Candy. I did a lot of stuff with Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis with the McKenzie Brothers, and worked on way too many shows. I've got, I think, 4 Emmys for working on Jim Henson's Muppet Babies. So I'm very happy because, as I said, not just for me, but the fact that so many of my friends from way back when followed their dream too. I mean, on the Muppet Baby show, the one thing, as corny as it sounds, is your dreams can come true. It was even in the theme song. And I think some of us here are kind of living proof that no matter how screwed up you are as a kid, you can eventually be screwed up for a living. So.
Thanks, Scott. I'm Roger Friedman, and this morning I was actually asked the question at breakfast by Barry Alfonso's charming wife, Janet, said, "Do you know where we're going?" referring to which hall we're going to. And my response was, "I'll give you the same answer I could give you on any morning of my life. No, but that's not going to stop me." And I think where I learned that was actually through the great good fortune I have of knowing through high school, as Scott mentioned, people like Scott, my good friend Dave Clark, Greg Bear, John Pound, and all these guys. And because of falling in with that group, I actually had the opportunity to get involved with Comic-Con at very early on, back in the days when the total number of people who attended the con would have fit very comfortably into this room with no lines outside. It's an amazing concept to think that it was once that small, and absolutely amazing to think how large it's become from that relatively small acorn. I think one reason we were so successful, despite being so young, was simply that we didn't know any better. And no one had told them, "You're just a kid, you can't do this stuff." And so since there was no one there to tell us that, we just went ahead and did it. And through that, I had the opportunity to actually contribute quite a bit to some of the programs that were actually the program books in the early days. I remember many fun afternoons over at Mike Towery's place with Richard Alf, putting together program books saying, "Oh my gosh, we have original Kirby artwork that we get to do stuff with. Isn't that totally cool? I'm holding this stuff." And so it was really a great experience. Had the wonderful opportunity to go on and become the auctioneer for a number of years for Comic-Con, which was a great experience. And some of the more venerable among you may remember the performances we did as part of Dr. Raoul Duke and his all-human orchestra. Where it was proved beyond a doubt that, yes, I simply cannot sing, but that didn't stop me either. So I really had a great time with all of that. And I think, quite literally, it shaped everything I've done since then, since my career since. I now actually teach physics and astronomy at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And the stuff that I found myself doing, including things like writing textbooks, creating computer software for education, and so on, none of those are things that I was ever trained to do. But by the same token, no one ever told me, "You can't do that stuff." So I've just done it. And it's actually worked out extraordinarily well. And I think that's probably the greatest lesson that I've gotten from the entire Comic-Con experience. One thing I will mention as well is that even though what I'm doing sounds like it's unrelated to comics, that's not true. If you look in my astronomy book, for instance, in the chapter on neutron stars, there is a end of chapter problem where the students have to calculate what is the mass of that sphere of white dwarf material that the atom picked up and used to make his costume whereby he could shrink himself. And so, if my students weren't comic fans before the class begins, they end up that way.
Ah, Roger, you're something else. You can finish me that way. I'm Ken Kruger, and my basic role at the beginning was to be the glue that brought these people together. There were two sort of separate groups, the comics and the science fiction people. Michelle and Roger and Scott, this group were the comic people. I knew the science fiction people, and I had the bookstore. I had a lot of bookstores. Originally, I was across from Balboa Park, and John and, oh God, how many of you, wandered in there one day, and we met, and we functioned. And then, one strange evening, we went up to Doc Shanus's house and formed Comic-Con. We didn't call it Comic-Con, we just wanted to put together a small one to see if we could put on a big one. And I keep hearing about the science fiction people and the comic people being separate groups. We weren't separate groups. We met, we liked each other, we had one good time from the beginning. All I did was sort of keep everybody happy and have a meeting place. And we had all sorts of fun. And that's what the whole thing started out as, a group to have a good time to have a lot of fun and to meet with other people and show them that, by God, I might be the geezer of the group, but these kids can do it. And by God, they did it.
Ken failed to mention the fact that he was an attendee at the very first science fiction convention ever held.
1939?
Yeah.
First fandom. Cool.
There's a photo of Ken in Harry Warner Jr.'s book, All Our Yesteryears, I believe is the title. And if any of you ever find a copy of that, well, you won't recognize him because he's so young in that. How old were you then, Ken?
17.
17.
You were probably hitting on Frank R. Paul's daughter, weren't you?
Sure was.
We met her recently. She was there, too. The thing about being part of this group was, through all these people, you know, I think I met Scott first of the group at Horace Mann High School for summer science class. Roger was at Pershing with me in ninth grade, so we were in ninth grade. I met David, who was in 10th at the time. I was in 11th. At Crawford High School. They all roped me into these other cultural things, and along the way, Ray Bradbury was giving a talk at San Diego High School, so David got me into that. So we both handed our screenplays, Phil Tippett and I handed in our screenplays to Ray Bradbury. We were going to do A Sound of Thunder in 1967. There's a lost film. Scott was going to be the hunter.
Yeah, we filmed footage at the San Diego Zoo's back service trails because my dad was the chief of security, and we were all dressed with pith helmets and practice rifles from the Navy that we borrowed and walked down into the zoo. People thought we were there to like shoot all the animals.
We probably still have footage of that somewhere. So all of this, let me explain what it was like in 1966, 67, 65, I don't know, first band. Some of these people go back to Stardust Convention, Westercon in San Diego, which was an awful and yet wonderful event. Ken remembers that.
Oh, boy.
The hookers couldn't get any action out of the fans because they all brought their own.
Yeah.
But it's 1965, 66. You're in high school, junior high school. Star Trek hasn't really gotten started yet, so it's Lost in Space is what we're watching regularly, and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and you know, we're kind of dubious about that. Oh, is this the greatest stuff ever? And then Star Trek comes along, blows us out of the water, conventions come up. There are five people in your high school who know what warp drive is. They're about that many, and most of them are here. They're about that many that understand that robotics might be interesting, computers might be interesting, right? And comic books, what, comic books? You're reading all that stuff, and you're reading science fiction. We remember these days, and we're sitting there telling them, no, you don't understand. Looking forward into the future, there will be a day when what we love will dominate 70% of the entertainment industry. And then we look farther ahead, and it will be called Golden City Comic Con. What was the first name we had?
Golden State.
Golden State. Golden State. Comic-Con, and so here it is. There it is. We were, in fact, we had more power than Joe Stalin, and we didn't know it. But that was really fascinating, and for me, to be introduced to all these other parts of science fiction and comics and everything, and to meet Jack Kirby at meetings, and you know, to hang out with this guy was a publisher. So he would buy artwork and introductions from us, from John Pound, from me, from other artists working.
He published my first story.
Yeah, there we go. Ken was part of Shroud Press. And in his bookstore, if you wandered around and looked in the right places, there'd be the porno edition of Ulysses by James Joyce over here, which he gave us because he couldn't sell it. But upstairs, you go upstairs, and there are boxes of artwork and books. And he and John Hall ran a sort of, let's supply the young fans with their collector's items stuff. And we still have material that we bought from these gentlemen. And believe me, when we went upstairs, it wasn't just money, because Ken would hand out a Virgil Finlay here. He would hang out. And I've got a drawing that goes back to the even earlier generations of fandom. I have a drawing by a fellow named Charles McNutt, of a sorcerer sitting in his laboratory staring into something. And Charles McNutt, this is 1948, 49, and you knew him.
Oh, yeah, before he became Beaumont.
He became Charles Beaumont.
Mm.
One of Ray Bradbury's acolytes. Ray Bradbury was his mentor, one of the Richard Matheson, Beaumont, Bradbury group that later would dominate the Twilight Zone and everything. So Ken is a center of history for all of us here. David is one of my muses by bringing me in. Scott and Roger introduced me to Tommy and to comic books, respectively. One debate that Scott and I haven't solved is who was the better writer, H.G. Wells or Edgar Rice Burroughs? We're still working on that.
Tell them what you do.
Oh, I write science fiction now. I write books. I'm on the 30 books so far published in 20 languages. It isn't too bad at this stage.
Hi there, everybody. My name is Richard Al. Although I know everybody up here at the table, I came from a slightly different, I entered the group in a slightly different way. I was started as a comic collector in the late 1950s, and I became a comic dealer in the early 1960s. Started advertising in Marvel Comics in 1969. And because of that, added Marvel Comics, I came to the attention of Barry Alfonso, who's somewhere down the table there. Barry at the time was about 12 years old. And Barry had the good fortune of being the first comic fan that Shel Dorff, who was the founder of this convention, called when he came to San Diego from Detroit in the summer of 1969. And Barry said, you know, I've got a few comics, but I know this other guy that has thousands of comics, and you really ought to talk to him. His name is Richard Alp, and he's got an added Marvel. So Shel Dorff got a hold of me. I met Shel. He was a very nice man. He was about twice my age at the time. I was 17. He was about 35. He presented himself as a very serious collector of comic art. Dick Tracy, primarily Steve Canyon, and others. And he also told me about a comic book convention that he'd done in Detroit for a number of years called the Detroit Triple Fan Fair. And he said, Rich, you know, my dream is to do something like this in San Diego as well. And would you be willing to help me do that? And I told him that I would, and that I would throw the resources of my mail order business behind the convention. And I would also bring in two of my closest friends who live in the same neighborhood with me, Mike Towery, who was a comic book dealer at the time, and also a very... a very close friend of ours, Bob Sorg, who's no longer with us as far as we know. But Mike was too young to drive, Bob was too young to drive, I had a car. I picked up Mike, I picked up Bob, I took him over to Shell's, and I explained, hey guys, I met this guy, he's like in his 30s, I don't know quite what to think of him. He seems to be in the comic books at least, and he's talking about wanting to do some sort of convention, and I think he might be serious, and maybe we ought to talk to him. So I brought Mike and Bob into the group. My understanding is that I also brought Dan Stewart into the group. He was one of my mail order customers, lived up in San Escondido. Also saw my ad, got a hold of me on the telephone, came down to buy comics from me. I told him about the group. He expressed an interest in joining. And we formed a nucleus and began talking about doing a convention. And it was shortly after that, as Scott said, he ran into Bob at a bookstore, eventually ended up at Shell's place, and John Pound eventually ended up there, Dave Clark, and Roger, and of course Greg, and Dave, and we decided at that point that we had enough critical mass to begin seriously planning for this convention. And I even have with me today, I was going through my check register from the time. I found my first check for the San Diego Comic Con was written February 10th, 1970 to Shel Dorff for expenses for the first Comic Con flyer, which would be the flyer for the mini con here. That was our one day convention. We did this as a test to see if the concept was viable. And once we felt the concept project is viable, then we should be seriously planning for a three-day convention, which I have a flyer here for that first three-day convention. And
those are my terrible drawings.
this is early artwork by the famous guy.
We've all got early artwork.
John Pound on the back.
Very likely John Pound on the back. Which one? Here, Dave, you can figure it out as I can. But I really got a little older, the old reading glasses. Bill, there we go. Okay. Let me run along. But this was how we began. We basically had no money to start. My mail order business was providing me with a good income. I was in high school at the time. I was living with my parents. I didn't need the money I was making. And I really liked the idea of a Comic Con. And so I became the treasurer of the group. And the way it worked is we had no money, so I just wrote checks on my personal account until the convention began to accumulate enough funds to pay for itself. And I did that actually all the way through the end of 1972. The very last check I wrote for the convention were for the 1972 program book that I wrote on August 18th, 1972, which was the first day of our 1972 convention at the El Cortez, because the Comic Con didn't have enough money. See, almost everybody at that time paid at the door. We didn't have enough money to pay to get the program book printed in time for the convention, so I had to write a check even in 1972 to pay for the program book, so we'd have them to get out on the day of the convention, and then they were able to pay me back after the convention was over and we took in the proceeds.
I bet then you were gainfully employed.
Absolutely, yeah, if I wasn't...
Use the money bags on the group.
Well, you know, it's really funny that I never really made a big deal about this. Part of the reason I didn't is I felt that we were trying to recruit as many volunteers as we could at the time to help us do this. And I didn't want anybody to feel that the convention was not financially viable. So rather than saying we had a lot of money, I just made sure that the issue of money was never discussed. And that way we were able to focus on building the convention and not having to worry about the money. And that's pretty much why I did that. But interestingly enough, I was talking to Shell years later, and he was commenting to me, you know, Rich, it's amazing that we were able to do this whole thing with no money. We never had a financial angel to help us out. All we had were our 50-cent dues that we collected at our club meetings to make this work. And I had to break the news to him. I said, Shell, I was the financial angel. And that's why I handled the finances and you handled the people.
Was a 10% loan accumulated over 40 years.
He has the stubs here.
He has the stubs. He's got the financial proof.
Why do you think he saved them?
I still save the receipts.
That's it.
All right, there you go.
And what are you doing now, Rich? Richard, what are you doing today?
Oh, well, I have taken an interest in the stocks and commodities markets. I trade stocks and commodities. I find it a little bit easier than trading collectibles because it's easier to find them when you want to buy them and get rid of them when you want to sell them. I've also taken an interest in playing poker online.
Same thing.
Comic-Con poker, no difference.
So you're still wheeling and dealing, is that
right? Absolutely. And my hobby is I like a certain genre of old Mexican movies called cabaret films that were produced between roughly 1945 and 1955 in Mexico. And they feature women that professionally dance the rumbera, the rumba, and the mambo, and feature classic bands from Cuba and other places like that. It's another genre that I think a lot of people haven't discovered yet, but I personally know it very fast.
When's that convention?
Scott, you kind of beat me to the punch there. We are starting the planning.
Scott's got the outfit.
All right.
Don't give him
that's right. You also have the first, I think probably one of the first comic book stores around, First Kingdom.
Oh, that's right. I started the Comic Book Kingdom in San Diego in 1975. I was actually the second store, just to my knowledge. The Shanus brothers started Pacific Comics about a year before I did. And the Shanus brothers started the first store in San Diego about a year before I did the Pacific Comics. But I was probably second when they started in San Diego, called the Comic Book Kingdom on University Avenue. And the store, even though I only kept it for about a year and a half, it remained in business for about 20 years under the leadership of Jack Dickens.
Leadership.
How did you become a distributor for Marvel at that tender age?
Well, I wasn't with my store or with my mailing business?
With your mailing business.
Oh, okay. With my mailing business, I had no business relationship with Marvel. What I was doing is I was buying up kids' comic collections, and then I was cataloging the comics, and then I would put out a list of those comics for sale. I actually did write to the companies at one point and asked them about buying new comics. I think it was back in 1969, 1970. They said if I would buy 100 copies of an issue, they would sell them to me wholesale. But I didn't need the depth as much as I needed the variety, and so I never took them up on the offer.
Yeah, I'm Dave Clark, and I was very fortunate to be one of the Crawford High School gang and to associate early on with such a talented, intelligent, funny people. These guys were my best friends. And the great thing about Crawford, which is a very, very big school, is that there were enough critical mass, there were enough to be interested in our special area of interest. And so you weren't alone as a fan. And every day at school was like being at a small convention. And
then
you would socialize and hang around the newspaper office for the school paper. Yeah. Scott was drawing cartoons for them. John Pound drew. I wrote for a long time, had worked with John Pound. I wrote comics with John. And Roger was there, and Greg, and so you bump into him in the hallway, and you keep the flame alive all the time. And when Ken moved to town, I heard actually that he was coming. My friend Kevin McClary got a mail order catalog from Ken, and he said, "Hey, this guy is coming to San Diego. He's opening a bookstore." So we, Kevin and I, and Scott and Roger, we all got involved in going down to Ken's store. And summertime came, and we thought it would be a great idea to have a science fiction club here in San Diego. And so we started to meet at the bookstore in Ocean Beach. And we had a great time. And apropos of Ken, I want to say, for some reason it brings to mind Mark Twain's adage about never let your schooling interfere with your education. And I learned a lot about the approach to life from Ken and from those early days of conventions. And I think what Roger said about not knowing things aren't possible, it's kind of like Shuno Suzuki, the Zen priest who founded the San Francisco Zen Center. He wrote a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and that you have to approach things with a beginner's mind, unclouded by preconceptions about what's not possible. And this whole convention was an exercise in that, not knowing what was not possible, and just doing it. And we meeting up with Richard and the group of the comic guys, really a synergistic kind of thing set in, and the convention just occurred. It seemed to happen by itself, although obviously Richard's money there to help out with his guidance, and Ken herding us along. You know, Ken told me something early on, one of the first meetings, he said, every organization needs a ramrod. It's really true. And I kept it in mind my whole life. Dude, somebody's got to be there to move the thing along. And Ken was the guy who moved the thing along and make sure we didn't get caught up in just talking about, you know, who would win, Thor or the Hulk.
Yeah, it's really true. I always told people, I mean, and this is nothing against Shell, who is not here because he's
in very poor health and really can't attend. But I really don't think there was ever any one founder. I've always thought that of the three of these guys, because Ken had the know-how. Ken had worked in publishing. Ken knew all these people from science fiction. He'd been to conventions for years. Shell knew all these guys in comic books and comic strips. And Richard provided the money for us to be able to take this stuff, you know, keep going one step further. It was the perfect combination.
There's also something else I think you're picking up on here, is that these guys were really smart. All of them are young, but they're also very efficient and capable, almost at a cellular level. So the organization came out of some good common sense interactions where we self-corrected. If we go off the deep end, we would kind of, you know, bring each other back and so on. And so in a way, it was a synergy of people who would grow up to be successful anyway. But all together in one place, this is the hard thing to explain, is how did it all happen in San Diego, in Southern California, that there was this group that could reach out around the world ultimately, but up into Los Angeles, Ray Bradbury comes down. We get Bill Paul here. Bud Plant was at the first, put a booth up at the first convention. I mean, all of these things coming together, it really is kind of a cyclone here. It's fascinating.
Excuse me, I want to pick up on that, but I want Dave to finish what he was saying. I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Let's see, where was I?
Ramrods.
Yeah, they were
essential. Ken had some of those on display in his store.
Yes, there's a lot of ramrods.
I don't know if I have more to say about that other than that I worked for Richard. I think I was one of his first employees in the bookstore. I worked for the Sheamuses at Pacific Comics. I wrote Underground Comics with John Pound. I'm very sorry that he's not with us here today. John is just a great guy and a wonderful friend. And we had a swell time writing Underground Comics, creating guys like characters like Flip the Bird and
Balaam and his ass.
Some really fun things. We had an awful lot of fun in those days. And I wish he were here today. For myself, working in the book trade for a number of years, I discovered that I had another talent, a sense of smell and taste and a palate memory. And I got involved in the fine wine industry, where I worked for the last 25 years. It's kind of a mysterious realm, very different. This is all visual. And the world of wine is olfactory. But it's a realm where the intellect and the sensory part of our nature come together and dovetail, and each enhance the other. So I moved to a different sense in the sight. But I've always kept a love for comics and science fiction, imaginative literature of all kinds, and especially my great favorite, my dear H.P. Lovecraft. Still, I'm pulling on and rereading him, and it's just even more wonderful than ever. Anyway, it's wonderful to be here today. I think I've been to all the three conventions, and I missed last year because I had a liver transplant. So I watched you all on TV last year. I'm very happy to be here today.
It's a pretty crummy experience. I'm not trying to take this over, but I wanted to say something about what Greg said, because I think it's really important. Greg acted like we knew what we were doing in a certain way. I have to dispute that. I was born in New York, but I grew up here in San Diego. And of course, San Diego has always been first and foremost a tourist destination. Now, back then, the comic book industry was really centered in New York City, and almost all the cartoonists had to live within delivery range of the publishers in New York. And as kids, it didn't occur to us, but later as I became a cartoonist, I suddenly realized why this clicked. All these freelancers back east could suddenly charge the expense of coming out here on their IRS returns, and they could look like a hero to their family by, hey, I'm going to bring the kids out to San Diego, honey. As well, it's about time to sit there hunched over that drawing board all day. And, you know, the publishers were happy because we had the blessing of Jack Kirby so early on, and in those days, it was absolutely obvious that Jack was the most vital force in comics. So it was like we suddenly had the testimonial of the King of Comics. And I don't think it ever really occurred to us until later that this was like the perfect lure for cartoonists and talented people, because they could come and hang out with weirdos while their families could go, you know, down to the beach and to the zoo and everything. And I'm not kidding. I really think that that had a real strong appeal to schlubs like me that were trying to draw funny books for a living.
Well, I think Scott, I think you're pointing out something really important that I've thought about lately, because Mike came across some old interviews that we had recorded with Jack up at his house in 1970 and 71. And one thing that struck me about him, two things struck me. One is the respect that he gave us in sitting here when we'd visit him at his home, answering these innumerable questions about the minutiae of his characters and what he was doing. But also, we gave him something. I mean, as great a man as Jack Kirby was, I don't know if he had that kind of personal connection with people that were devoted to his art to the degree that we were. And if he didn't get it, I'm sure innumerable other cartoonists and comic artists didn't as well. So I think that the Comic-Con provided something to probably a fair amount of fairly isolated people who were great at what they did but didn't have this sort of personal respect and this personal contact from young kids and older people that loved what they did. So I think that was a big draw,
that's
as well as the San Diego weather.
That's an excellent point. Yeah. And I also have to point out something, that he particularly liked you, because he not only provided visually a basis for a character in the San Diego Five-String Mob that Jack turned us into characters in an issue of Jimmy Olsen, but also Clarion the Witch Boy was more or less a interpretation, a very far out interpretation of Barry. And I gotta tell you something that you probably don't know. Jack once told Mark Evanier that he really liked you, but he didn't think you were gonna live very long. I'm not kidding, because you were a little kid, you were real skinny,
yeah.
You were very smart, and Jack was convinced somehow that you were gonna like die of some sort of childhood disease. I'm not kidding. He gave you some sort of helmet at one time, some sort of,
I don't know,
sort of thing. He gave you something, and Mark said he wanted you to have something because he thought it'd give you something to live for. I'm not making this up.
Well, that's why I made the pact with the devil.
I can only tell you that because you're obviously fine. So whatever Jack thought was going to happen to you, you dodged it somehow.
That portrait that Jack did of you was in the closet upstairs.
Well, I understand that the Kirby family attorney is going to be here on Sunday to finally disclose the secret here.
He liked you for that reason, and I don't know why he liked me. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to show you something that Mike published. You probably can't see it from here, but this is a Xerox of an old copy of Strange Tales. And there's a big monster here in an arena. He's saying, "Your planet is doomed, for no human can beat me." Now, there are a lot of there aren't too many little kids here. If there are little kids here, close your eyes. I drew this poster. I was doing Underground Comics. I love Jack, but I now realize it was like having a pet cat who comes up and drops a dead rat on your chest when you're asleep. This was the poster that Mike printed up in, I don't know how many, 1,000 of them. "No human can beat me off." The monster with a phallus as long as he is tall. And I took this up to Jack and said, "Jack, this is in honor of you." And Jack knew I was doing Underground Comics, but Jack kind of stumbled. He was like, really, just like, and then he said, "Well, I've got a family, and I really couldn't take that." I swear, I said, "Jack, you could hang it in a closet." And you know, if somebody did that to me, I'd have a you know, court order out to, you know, keep him away from me. And instead, Jack had me over to his house many, many times. They came to our, he went to birthday parties. We named our son Kirby. Jack came down to see the baby and gave us artwork for Kirby, who's now 17 years old. But, you know, he was the nice kid. I was the evil kid, and he liked us both. So that's just what a great guy he
You
was.
Were evil in ninth grade, Scott. So.
I'd like to say something about Shel Dorsfeld with the convention.
Let's get that. Just one sec. Okay. I'm William Arlen.
I'm sorry.
I came into the group a little bit later than these guys. I wasn't raised or, you know, here in San Diego. I was born and raised in Spokane, Washington, and much like these guys, I also had a group of friends. We all hung out in our lunch break in high school, and we discussed comics and science fiction and everything. And then I went into the Navy and came down to San Diego, went through boot camp, and went over to Vietnam. And while I was there, I talked to one of my friends back in Spokane. I'm kind of bored here. There's not a lot to do, believe it or not. Because in the Navy, you're just there for support activity. So we started publishing a fanzine, and I did interviews by mail with people like Kurt Swan, Bernie Rice, and published them in a fanzine with the what we thought was such an original title, the Collector's Chronicle. But anyway, it wasn't very embedded. And then I came back here and was stationed at Miramar, and I thought, well, okay, I'm kind of bored here too, you know. I wanted to get involved in some fan activity, and the one person that I knew I could contact was the one person who had an ad in comics, and that was Richard Al. And he said, sure, let me pick you up at Miramar, and pick me up at VW Bug, and those two tall guys there riding in up to the meeting. That's how I met with these group of guys. Everybody kind of fell in place. Later on, after I got out of the Navy, I stuck around, just stayed here. Bob Sork, in fact, ended up being one of my neighbors. At the time, I was living in Lynn Vista. So got to know Bob a lot better there. He was down the next building in the apartment complex I lived in. What I'm doing now, I'm acting. Primarily on stage, done a little bit of film and TV work, and doing a little bit of writing. And I've written for magazines like Fangoria and Comic Scene. Interviewed people like Bill Keane. So that's kind of, you know, all throughout the fanzine work. And from there, just working on some other projects. You wanted to speak about Shel Dorf. I thought we should speak about Shel and anybody else, like John Hall, Bob Sorp, anybody else that really you feel contributed quite a bit to this convention. John Pound, those who are not here with us today for one
Bill,
reason or another.
I'm in kind of a unique position in that I spent more time with Shel Dorf than probably anybody else at the table. And yeah, except for movie again. Right. He was the movie again bookstore. But I have stories to tell that a lot of the other guys may not know because I spent a lot of time with Shel that other people didn't spend. But I wanted to tell everybody exactly what we did in the very beginning and how Shel helped us do that. One of Shel's particular talents when he was dealing with us as young guys is I later realized he knew everything that we were going to do, but he only showed us a little bit at a time. And I think the day that we really began to trust Shel was a day when we showed up at his house one day, and he started asking us questions like, how many of you guys know Jack Kirby's artwork? And we all raised our hands, of course. And he said, how many of you guys have actually talked to Jack Kirby? And none of us had. And then he asked us a key question. He said, how many of you guys would like to talk to Jack Kirby. Given the opportunity. And, you know, there were just a few of us there. We were all pretty young. We were all Fantastic Four fans and Avengers fans. And we said, sure, we'd love to talk to Jack Kirby. But how in the world are we ever going to get that opportunity to do that? And so Shell said, well, what if I call Jack right now and pass the phone around the table? And we can all say hello to him. And we didn't quite know what to say at that point. We kind of looked at Shell and said, is this guy on the level or what? So I remember Shell dialed the number, and he's on the phone, and says, hi, Roz, yeah, this is Shell Dorff down here in San Diego. Is Jack there, please? Hi, Jack, yeah, how you doing? Shell Dorff, San Diego. Hey, I've got a bunch of your fans here that we'd like to say hello to you. And he just hands the phone to the first guy at the table. I forget who it was. Was it you, Barry, or?
I don't remember. Mike? Could have been.
And we just passed the phone around, and that was our first contact with Jack Kirby. Now, I later learned that Shell had only known Jack for about 2 or 3 months, because he didn't tell us that. He just kind of pulled these things out of the hat. And that's what led to our first Jack Kirby trip. Another thing that impressed me about Shell is the way he handled the whole convention issue. He talked to us about doing a Comic-Con, got us to the point where we kind of liked the idea, and then he started running us through an exercise. He says, well, let's debate this issue. He says, first of all, do you think there's room on the national scene for another comic book convention? And, you know, we had the Comic Arts Convention in New York, we had the Detroit Triple Fan Fair, I think there was the Chicago Con going, some things in Texas. And I remember one of the people at the table, one of the points that was raised, is somebody actually said, are we too late? Are there already too many other conventions going? I mean, it's really incredible when you think back on it that we weren't sure. But we decided, well, we'll give it a try. And then Shell said, well, then do you think that San Diego is an appropriate place for this type of convention? Keeping in mind that the bulk of the industry was on the East Coast at that time, and if we had guests, we'd have to fly most of them out. Whereas with Bill Sewing in New York, he could just pick them up in a cabin and take them to lunch. You know, it was a very different situation for us. But we again felt that we would like a convention in San Diego, regardless of whether it would work or not. And then he asked us the third question, which is really the key question, and that is, did we as a group feel that we were capable of putting on this convention? And I think at that point we all said yes, we'd like to go ahead with it. So that was one little session with Shell. And then a later session with Shell began like this. He says, okay, now that we've decided to do this convention, the first thing we need to do is set a date. And I had never been into long-range planning like that before. The idea of committing ourselves to a date was a little frightening. But we eventually, I think this was in late 1969, we decided that August of 1970 would be a good time to do the convention. Then we had to come up with a name. I mean, it was just a step-by-step process that Shell took us through. Let's come up with a name. And because San Diego was not that well known at the time, we labeled it the Golden State Comic-Con because we figured people knew where California was, but they didn't know where San Diego was. And so it was a way of first showing that we're on the West Coast, and then on our logo we put a little dot down at the bottom where San Diego was to say, hey, we're over here, down at the bottom of the state, you know. And then after that, we had to come up with a logo. And I remember Shell, with his experience with the Detroit Triple Fan Fair, they had a focus on comic books, films, and science fiction. And so we just followed Shell's lead, and we said, well, we're going to have comic books and science fiction and films as part of our basic setup as well. We called it a Comic-Con because we were a comic book group, and we didn't understand that you weren't supposed to have science fiction and films in there. I mean, this was kind of the blueprint we were given, and we ran with it. And that's why it has the triple focus that it has. But it was called a Comic-Con because it originated from comic fans primarily. And then after that, another thing that amazed me about Shell, and I was talking about this with Mike Tarry the other night, is Shell really knew no fear. He said, okay guys, the next step is we need to go down to the San Diego Convention and Visitors Bureau and let them know what we're going to do. And it's like, we didn't have anything at that time. We hadn't even printed our first flyer yet. We had absolutely nothing, but we still went down there. We introduced ourselves, and we said we're going to be doing this. We'd like their help. And they not only gave us help for the mini-con, but they've been helping the convention, I understand, ever since. But that's where that relationship started, and then Rochelle took the initiative to go through the front door of the San Diego Convention Visitors Bureau and just introduce himself and us as a group of kids. We were going to do this thing called a Comic-Con. And I remember people were constantly asking us, well, what is a Comic-Con? Is it like for stand-up comics, or what is this thing? And we were constantly having to explain ourselves. And then the next step, which I think really scared me, I don't know how Mike felt about this, but he says, okay guys, now that we've made our minds up, we've got to let the world know what we're going to do. So we're going to go down to the San Diego Union, and we're going to tell them that we're going to make history, and we want to talk to a reporter. And I said, Shell, we don't have anything to show. He says, it doesn't matter. These people have to print something. They're always looking for news. There's never enough. And so he took us down to the paper, and we gave our story, and they printed it. And then he said, okay, now we have to go after the television stations. And I remember driving Shell to Channel 10, and that's where he met Bob White for the Jack White for the first time. And another fellow by the name of Gil Martinez, I think it was, who was in the production. And we did that. And then he said, we have to start going to the radio stations and announcing ourselves. And we're literally doing this with nothing. We didn't even have our first flyer printed yet. And yet we're out there acting like we've got this big deal going.
Richard, while you're talking about TV, talk about the time you guys had to go down to Mexico.
Oh, God. In San Diego at that time, we had three basic stations. We had Channel 10 and Channel 8 and Channel 6. The thing that made Channel 6 different is that its call letters started with an X. Because east of the Mississippi River, the call letters start with a Q. West of the Mississippi River, they start with a K. And then when you go down into Mexico, they start with an X. And so Channel 6 was actually a station that was based in Mexico, but was broadcasting into the United States in English. And so we decided, well, we got to cover all bases. And there was a show that came on in the mornings called Coffee Break. It was hosted by Raph Algren, a very interesting character. I think Barry is a Raph Algren fan, in fact.
You bet, the man.
And so we made an appointment to go down and see Raph, crossed the border, took a cab, told the guy we'd like to go to Channel 6. Well, what we didn't understand is that Channel 6 was on the top of a mountain. And the road up the mountain was a very narrow little road that kind of wound around and wound around and around and wound around. And this cab driver was speeding up this hill at full speed. And every time a car would be in front of us that was going too slow, he would go around the car. The car is on the curves. And I mean, I'm looking out the window at this, you know, this 100-foot drop as this guy's going around these curves. Other cars are coming toward us. And we didn't even know if we were going to live to get to the station. It was absolutely insane. And then once we got there, we were very impressed to find that they had all the latest electronic equipment. They were bringing in all their cameras from Japan, Sony equipment, all this state-of-the-art stuff. And we thought, wow, this is really pretty cool. You know, here we are in Mexico, up on the top of this mountain, and they're actually pretty civilized over here. But then Raph led us into his studio, and that was another matter. Because he had a couch and a couple of chairs. Stuffing was coming out of the couch. Stuffing was coming out of the chairs. In the background was one of these sliding glass doors like you'd have at your house, and then a wall about a foot behind that with a mural on it of an outdoor scene to kind of create the impression that you're actually in a house looking through the doors. And then, of course, the famous stairway to nowhere, you know, that goes up to the ceiling and stops, but they don't show the ceiling, they, you know, quick crop the shot, so it looks like it's just a stairway to the second floor. And Raph would film, like, three shows a day to save money. So the people on right before us were demonstrating rattlesnakes. And we're like, Raph, I think we'll stand out here for a while until this current presenter gets done with the snakes, and then maybe we'll come into the studio after that. And then I remember sitting down, and Raph said, okay guys, give me the juice on this thing. What is this comic thing? Come on, give me a headline or something that I can use. And then he says, oh, and by the way, could you guys kind of position yourself? Like, Rich, could you put your arm on the chair so that the stuffing isn't exposed? Furniture and now this cushion has stuffing coming out of it. Could you kind of move over and sit on top of that so they can't see that stuffing on the screen? And
Oaky Bob, a couple of weeks. Kicked with this boot a bunch of times.
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, this furniture looked worse than what you buy at the Goodwill. I mean, here they are, state-of-the-art cameras, and the cheapest furniture, you know, from a junkyard. And this guy was such a character. I mean, like I say, Barry and I are going to make a pilgrimage this year to...
We might have talked about it.
To Raph's house, just because he's such a character.
Are they going to force you to get your hair cut first, like they did?
Yeah, right.
You didn't tell them that.
Oh, well that... Did I have to get my haircut from Mexico? I thought.
Yeah, you went across the border.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah, because they had like attitude inspectors, and they didn't like to have hippies in Mexico.
A country with a dress code.
Yeah.
Tuck your shirt in.
Yeah, and, you know, Scott never grew his back.
That's right.
It was fascinating, though, the way Shell just pushed ahead. I mean, he really knew no fear. He wanted to do things on a grandiose scale. And it didn't really matter that we had nothing to show for ourselves except our ideas. He was able to bring it across and build credibility, and that's a lot of what got this thing going to the beginning.
Who brought in Ackerman and Bradbury? Was that Ken?
Now, let me tell you my Bradbury story. You know, it's interesting how all of our memories are kind of getting worse. And I recently read an interview that Shell had done a number of years ago where he talked about meeting Ray Bradbury at UCSD. What he failed to mention is that I had driven him out there that day in my Volkswagen because Shell didn't have a car and he didn't have any money. And we had gone out there to hear Ray speak and at one of the auditoriums on Mobile campus. And after the speech, we made a decision to talk to Ray. My recollection of the event is that we were outside the entry doors to one of the Revell auditoriums, and Ray came out, and I let Shell do the talking. And I said, I took care of the money, Shell took care of the people. So Shell did the talking, and again, he basically introduced us to Ray, and he told us about what we were doing in San Diego, and I don't believe at this time that we'd even done the mini-con. Again, Shell was talking out of his hat, so to speak. He had nothing, but he instead just told Ray that what he was going to do and didn't tell him that we hadn't done anything yet. And I remember Ray thought it was a good idea, and he said, you know, Mr. Dorf, sounds like what you're doing is a good idea. I'd love to be a guest of yours. My standard speaking fee is $5,000. I do not fly on planes, so you'll need to pay my train fare down from Los Angeles and put me up in a hotel. And Shell and I kind of looked at each other. I had some money to fund the convention with, but not $5,000 at that moment. And then Shell had this amazing inspiration. He turned to Ray and he says, Ray, we are a non-profit organization. And we are doing this as a public benefit for educational purposes. I mean, this is a great line. And Ray turned to us then and said, well, if that's the case, then I'll do it for free. And that's how we got Ray Bradbury as our first science fiction guest. And I understand he's been attending ever since because he had such a good time at that first convention.
Just an addendum to that, Shell told me a while back that up until that very moment, he hadn't really thought about whether or not the convention would be nonprofit or profit. He hadn't given a lot of thought, but on the spur of the moment there, he decided, okay, it's going to be nonprofit. And I think that's been a big part of the success of Comic-Con, that it was a volunteer organization of people that just, you know, loved comics and science fiction and wanted to volunteer their time to do that.
And then later the organization got it right and actually incorporated a nonprofit organization.
Shell, by the way,
Ken, yeah. Maybe you can speak Shell, a little bit about Shell. And
just after these meetings, Shell had a little bit of problems with his mother and father, and he moved into the back room at my bookstore. And he lived there for 6 years. So I got to know Shell pretty well. And I will tell you right now that Shell was a go-getter. He wouldn't take no for an answer. He was a good guy and one hell of an organization man. One of my best friends. And I wish there was something we could do for him now. I know what he's going through. I take dialysis 3 times a week. And I hate to say it, but I advised him not to. And I regret that. I truly regret it. So, Shell is very near and dear to me. And these, let's let it go with that. But we certainly should all say a prayer for Shell. Thank you.
John Hall is important to
our group. John, yes.
Is there something you want to speak to?
Yeah, John Hall. I'd like to just say a word at him and honor John a bit. A couple of my friends from school and the guy who went to different high school, we were big Edgar Rice Burroughs fans. And we heard that somehow my friend Bo met John Hall someplace, and he said, we're going out to his garage. He's got a bunch of books out there. And so we drove out, where is that really? It's past Spring Valley, out in the sticks at the time, in the East County. And we went to his house, and John was an older guy, cigar smoker, as I recall, and he opened his garage, perfectly ordinary looking suburban house, and it was packed to the gunnels with cool collectible books.
Amazing
and
stuff.
First editions of McClurg, first editions of Burroughs and Pulps, and
Clark Ashton Smith and Lovecraft.
Clark Ashton Smith and H.P. Lovecraft, and I saw it, and I knew I was going to get in serious trouble with this. And we used to make regular pilgrimages to John's garage to buy collectibles and cool books. And because he'd been around fandom a long time, he knew a lot. And he could regale you, like Ken, could regale you with stories.